Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in this Labor Day weekend. The Book of Mormon is an interesting artifact, isn't it? Where did it really come from? Now, if you look at the Book of Mormon itself, past the title page, you will find some pretty amazing claims made there. Some witnesses who say that they saw Joseph Smith translate this book from golden tablets given to him from the divine realm. Well, are those claims about the Book of Mormon true? If they are, I think it's fair to say that Mormonism is true. If they aren't, then does Mormonism fall like a house of cards? We're going to talk about who really wrote the Book of Mormon tonight on Issues, Etc. You can join this conversation. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. We are coming to you live this Sunday night, September the 4th. 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our guests tonight to talk about the Book of Mormon, Art Vanek and Wayne Cowdery. They are members of Spalding Research Associates. They're co-authors, along with Howard Davis, of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon? Art and Wayne, welcome to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you for having us on the show.
Yes, thank you very much.
Art, we begin with you. What is the Book of Mormon? Is it what Mormons believe and think it is?
Well, yeah, that's kind of a loaded question in a way. I mean, of course, the Mormons firmly believe that it is their most sacred book, one of the standard works, as they call them, and the divine record of the lost tribes of Israel, which came to the Americas. Although, after doing several years of research, it is our conclusion that instead of being an ancient record, it was in fact the early 19th century creation of a retired Congregationalist minister named Solomon Spaulding.
Now we're going to go into some more detail on that very subject in a few minutes, but first, Wayne, you once were a Mormon. How important is the Book of Mormon to Mormon theology, to Mormonism?
Well, I'll tell you, it's the life and it's the bread and butter and the life force of the Mormon Church. It's actually the foundation, because if that book is swept out from under them, you won't have a Mormon Church any longer. It's actually a record of an alleged lost tribes of Israel, and if you can show that there is no connection between them being descendants of the Jews, which was a very popular theory back in those days, then once again, the book will fall. And as I said before, it's actually the foundation of the church.
So it is safe to say, as I said in our open, that if the Book of Mormon's claims about itself, there on the title page, to be of divine origin through Joseph Smith's translation, if those are in fact false and there's some other origin to the Book of Mormon, then Mormonism itself is called into question. Is that safe to say, Wayne?
Yes, that is correct. And also, I'd like to mention that these other witnesses, and they're all claim to have this testimony on the eye of faith. So that's what you have to go on, really.
Yeah, they never, in fact, saw the physical plates. When they were interviewed at length later on, they all said that they only saw the golden plates and the other plates with the eye of faith, not physically.
Yeah.
Okay, Art, go into that just for a second, because I want to get into the whole Solomon Spaulding story. But first of all, what does Joseph Smith claim? Where does he claim the Book of Mormon's origins are, according to Joseph Smith?
Well, he claimed that he was visited by the angel Moroni, who told him where he could find these various plates in a mound, and he had to dig them up and translate these plates out of a language that he called Reformed Egyptian, which, by the way, no reputable Egyptologist has ever verified. In fact, even the Smithsonian Institute says there's no such thing as Reformed Egyptian. Yeah. So we have Joseph Smith claiming to translate plates out of a language for which there is no valid existence. We have no physical evidence of the plates. We have the witnesses only claiming to see these plates by the eye of faith. So one would have to ask at this point, you know, just what kind of evidence is there, you know, that this book came out through the origin or through the manner in which they claim. And it's very interesting to note that Solomon Spaulding, at the beginning of his manuscript found, claims to have found his book in the same manner. He found it in an Indian burial mound. He had to dig up the mound. He found it in a box. He opened it with a lever. And Joseph Smith makes the same claim. Joseph Smith claims to have gone to a mound and dug and opened the box with a lever at the appointed time. And only after Moroni said, okay, you can do it now. You can finally look at this stuff.
Yeah.
And he had to keep going back year after year after year. Is it time now? No, it's not time. Is it time now? No, it's not time. Till such a time when Moroni finally says, okay, you can look at the box now. You can open it up, and you can do your translation. And, you know, nobody, not even the eyewitnesses, quote-unquote, ever physically saw those plates. But anytime anybody else tried to see the plates, all they saw, as in one instance with it was a pair of gentlemen who were with Smith at a pub or a roadhouse one time, and they asked Smith to see the plates, and he told them no. And when he walked away, they lifted up the sheet which was covering these plates, and all they found were a bunch of bricks. And when Joseph Smith came back and they confronted him about it and told him that all they saw was bricks, without batting an eye, Smith said, well, God knew that you were going to lift up the cover, and he transformed the plates into bricks to confound you. So, you know, one of the big operational words that helped the whole process come along at that time is gullibility. You have Joseph Smith, who was basically the P.T. Barnum of his day, making wild and outlandish claims and people believing him. And that was kind of part and parcel to the religious fervor of the day.
So then, Art, tell us about, we've got about a minute and a half here,
sure,
before we go to a break. Tell us about Solomon Spaulding, his manuscript. You already mentioned the title, Manuscript Found, and begin the story on how it became the Book of Mormon.
Okay. Briefly, Spaulding had tried several different businesses during the course of his life and had basically failed during all of them, and as a last resort turned to writing. And Manuscript Found was actually the second attempt at writing. He had a previous one called Manuscript Story, and he gave that up after about 100 or 120 pages or so, realizing that it wasn't going anywhere. And then he started into what we call Manuscript Found, which was basically about these tribes, these alleged lost tribes from Israel and coming to America, and you know, just the whole nine yards. And he finishes the book and takes it to Pittsburgh and gets a publisher to agree to publish it, on the proviso that Spaulding come up with some front money or seed money to help with the printing process. Unfortunately, though, Spaulding dies before he's able to raise the money.
We're talking with Art Vanek and Wayne Cowdery. Both are members of Spaulding Research Associates, about the Book of Mormon. They're co-authors, along with Howard Davis, of our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon? Feel free to join our conversation. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. We are coming to you live this Labor Day weekend, September the 4th. And our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. That email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints get top priority among our callers this evening. 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. So far, we have Solomon Spaulding, far in advance of Joseph Smith's fame, writing this bit of fiction, manuscript found. It sits in a publisher's office, and Solomon Spaulding, before he can have the thing published, dies. Well, we'll continue the story, the real story of the Book of Mormon, on the other side. Pastor Mark Schaefer, coordinator of continuing education and related events at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the importance of equipping the priesthood of all believers.
It's so important that, you know, the church, we have faithful pastors, but we also have faithful laypersons. The church can't exist without people. And the more that our laypeople understand their role and how they fit in the church, it's good for the church's mission. It's good for the church's service. It's good for the worship life of the church, too.
For more information about the fall retreats at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, a lay leadership retreat, an Enter the Bible World retreat, a Luther Hostel retreat, and a confirmation retreat, contact Concordia Theological Seminary toll-free 1-877-287-4338 or visit them online at www.ctsfw.edu.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Science seems to be moving at breakneck speed. How can Christians make ethical decisions on issues like stem cell research, abortion, and euthanasia? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, inviting you to join us for the Image of God Bioethics Conference, Friday, November the 11th at the Sheraton Westport Lakeside Chalet in St. Louis. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. regular guest Wesley Smith is one of the featured speakers. The Image of God Bioethics Conference, November the 11th in St. Louis.
If you enjoy listening to Issues Etc. on the weekends, did you know that you can listen to 12 new hours of Issues Etc. each week on the Internet? All you have to do is go to our website, issuesetc.org, click the worldwide KFUO logo, and there you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7, including 12 new programs weekly. The website address again, issuesetc.org.
Well, you can't help but be thankful for all the relief organizations that are swinging into action in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. They are certainly to be commended and supported in every way. But how do you know which one to support? One that understands the two most important things at a time like this, the concerns of both body and soul. That's why my contributions are going to LCMS World Relief. They understand the connection between body and soul, bringing a Christ-centered and cross-focused message with Christ-centered and cross-focused relief at a time of great human need. For more information about LCMS World Relief, check out our website. Look for the satellite image of Katrina there, issuesetc.org, or call LCMS World Relief toll-free, 1-888-930-4438. 1-888-930-4438. It is Christ-centered, cross-focused relief efforts. LCMS World Relief, 1-888-930-4438. We're talking about the Book of Mormon. Art, pick up the story where you left off there. Solomon Spaulding does not manage to publish this manuscript-found piece of fiction. He dies too soon. But in the book I read that even before Spaulding's death, this manuscript, at least for a time, mysteriously disappears from the publisher's office. Tell us.
Correct. And I'm glad that you brought that up, because I was just going to ask if I could backtrack to 1814. While Spaulding is still alive, and not too long after he submits the book and it gets accepted, the manuscript disappears for a while. And we believe that the person who made it disappear was a gentleman named Sidney Rigdon, who at that time was known to be a leather tanner and bookbinder, and was seen by many, many witnesses in the area frequenting both the different printing shops and publishing houses.
Yes, it's also interesting to note that one of the main witnesses we have in our book, whose name was Joseph Miller, who spent some time with Mr. Spalding toward the end of his years, had mentioned in his letters and everything that was left behind by him that Solomon Spalding told him personally that he suspected that Sidney Rigdon purloined the manuscript, that he stole this. And that's very interesting because that's been brought out by other witnesses too.
So we have various witnesses, like Wayne said, with Joseph Miller and others, even including the postmaster of Pittsburgh at the time, a woman named Mrs. Eichbaum, who said that she saw Sidney Rigdon frequenting the post office from time to time. Now, it's interesting to note, and it's been one of the bedrock claims of the Mormon Church ever since they've been in existence, that Sidney Rigdon was never in Pittsburgh before about 1820 or 1822. And so they maintain that if he was never there before that date, A, how could he have possibly known Spalding, and B, how could he have possibly ever known about or seen the Spalding manuscript? Well, for the first time ever, we have information in our book in the form of newspaper articles which show conclusively that Sidney Rigdon was not only in Pittsburgh before 1820, he was also there early enough for Spalding to have known him. Now, you know, for AOL members out there, you know, you have this thing that kind of dings or whatever, and it says, you have mail. Well, back then, they had kind of a 19th century version of it. If you did not pick up your mail within a certain amount of time, the post office sent a notice to the newspaper, and they would print out a list of people who had mail waiting for them. And as is shown in our book, we have a transcript of one of those different lists. And the one of the best ones of the whole bunch not only shows Sidney Rigdon's name on there, but also Solomon Spalding's name on there at the same time. So it places Rigdon in Pittsburgh early enough to have known Spalding, and it backs up the testimony of Eichbaum and all of those others who claimed to have seen Rigdon at that time.
And actually, we're talking about August of 1816, 4 years before 1820. So we actually have Sidney Rigdon nailed at that point for the first time, and we're very happy about it.
So your contention is that Sidney Rigdon is suspected of having purloined the manuscript that Solomon Spalding wrote. Manuscript Found was the title. This piece of fiction, very similar in its content to what would become the Book of Mormon. How did it go from Sidney Rigdon to Joseph Smith to the Book of Mormon, Art?
Okay. Enter Oliver Cowdery, who was not only Joseph Smith's second chief scribe, he was also one of Joseph Smith's cousins. And he frequented his brother Erastus Cowdery's home in Ohio at a time when Sidney Rigdon was a circuit riding preacher in Ohio at the same time, and Erastus Cowdery and Sidney Rigdon were practically next-door neighbors. And so at some point in the early 1820s, Cowdery and Rigdon get together. Rigdon tells Cowdery, I have a book, and it's of God, and it's an ancient record. And Cowdery knows Joseph Smith and the fact that Joseph Smith needs a book to become a prophet. And what's interesting about Joseph Smith and this whole prophet thing is that he wasn't even the first choice to be a prophet. He had an older brother named Alvin, or Alva. There are alternate spellings of it. And originally, Mother Smith had it in her designs for Alvin to become a prophet or the prophet, whatever. Unfortunately, Alvin took ill and died from a homemade remedy, we think mushrooms or something like that. And so the mantle fell from Alvin to Joseph. And Joseph had numerous occult and other sorts of mentors, and one of them, a man named Lumen Walters, told Smith that in order to be a prophet, he needed to have a book. And Oliver Cowdery lived with the Smiths at this particular time. He knew Joseph needed a book. He meets Sidney. Sidney needs some sort of an organization because he desperately wants to become a New World equivalent of the Apostle Paul. He wants to evangelize the United States. So Rigdon and Cowdery get together. Cowdery says, I've got to bring you to meet my cousin Joseph. Cowdery brings Rigdon to Smith. They get together. Smith sees the book, and over a period of about two and a half years, they work in a rather clandestine manner with bits and pieces going from Rigdon to Cowdery and Smith, with Cowdery being the editorial backbone. He was a journeyman printer by this time, and Joseph Smith maintaining the almost otherworldly sort of thing where he is allegedly behind this curtain looking through magical spectacles, if you will, at this, at these ancient plates written in this unknown language.
Hey, Art, let's take a break right okay. here in the story, and when we come back, we'll continue the story of the Book of Mormon as discovered by historical research. Quite different than Joseph Smith's version of where the Book of Mormon came from. That's our subject. Art Vanek and Wayne Cowdery are our guests. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. Members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints get top priority, 1-800-730-2727. Science seems to be moving at breakneck speed. How can Christians make ethical decisions on issues like stem cell research, abortion, and euthanasia? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, inviting you to join us for the Image of God Bioethics Conference, Friday, November the 11th at the Sheraton Westport Lakeside Chalet in St. Louis. For more information, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. regular guest Wesley Smith is one of the featured speakers. The Image of God Bioethics Conference, November the 11th in St. Louis.
If you enjoy listening to Issues Etc. on the weekends, did you know that you can listen to 12 new hours of Issues Etc. each week on the Internet? All you have to do is go to our website, issuesetc.org, click the worldwide KFUO logo, and there you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7, including 12 new programs weekly. The website address again, issuesetc.org.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again, talking with Maggie Carner, Executive Director of LCMS Life Ministries, about the upcoming Image of God Bioethics Conference here in St. Louis, November the 11th. Maggie, is bioethics a subject for ethicists and scientists only?
First of all, the term bioethics sounds sort of scary to the average person, and people feel sort of intimidated by that. But what we're talking about here, the actual noun, bioethics, means we're dealing with the implications of what's going on in medicine and science and scientific research and how that applies to the average person. And everyone needs to have be aware of what's going on culturally in this field today, especially clergy and scientists, of course, and medical professionals, and even right down to the folks sitting in our pews on Sundays.
So why the title Image of God Bioethics Conference?
We chose that title specifically because as Christians, we have always had a good understanding of what it means to be children of God, created for a special purpose and a special reason. And God has given us his image, and it talks about that clear back in Genesis. And so we've, today, that idea, traditionally our culture has always dealt with science and medicine with that idea in the back of their mind, that framework for understanding that the human, the Homo sapiens, are designed by God for a special purpose. And today that is getting muddied in the discussion, that concept and that understanding.
Finally, Maggie, tell us a little bit about some of the speakers that will be featured at the Image of God Bioethics Conference in November.
We've got some great speakers that are going to be there. We've got Gilbert Mailander, who is on President Bush's Bioethics Council in Washington, D.C. He also serves as a professor at Valparaiso. We've got Nigel Cameron, who he's testified before the United Nations about cloning. We've got Wesley Smith, who is a prolific author and lawyer who specializes in end-of-life issues, and he's been a frequent guest on Nightline and Good Morning America and some of the other, you know, popular shows on television. And all three of these keynote speakers are really dynamic speakers in their field.
For more information about the Image of God Bioethics Conference here in St. Louis, Friday, November the 11th, go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Folks, if you enjoy Issues Etc., and I know you do, we hear from you all the time, then I know that you'll enjoy one or more of the fall retreats coming up at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, this fall. They're hosting a lay readers, a catechism, a confirmation, and a Luther hostel retreat all this fall. Some great opportunities for you to study God's Word. For more information, call them 1-800-481-2155. 1-800-481-2155, or look for the logo for Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, at our website, issuesetc.org. They're equipping the priesthood of all believers, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. All right, I know it's a little difficult to tell the players without a program, but so far we have Solomon Spaulding. He writes a book of a manuscript of fiction about, well, about people come to America, the real origins of Native Americans. His manuscript left gathering dust at a Pittsburgh publishing house, disappears for a time, most likely into the hands of one Sidney Rigdon. From Sidney Rigdon, it passes to Oliver Cowdery, and Oliver Cowdery has an association with Joseph Smith and his family. So far appears to be a more or less deliberate effort to turn out something that would be the Book of Mormon. This is a story very different from the one we've heard so often, the claims made by Mormonism about the Book of Mormon, and the story isn't over yet. Art Vanek and Wayne Cowdery are our guests, members of Spaulding Research Associates and co-authors of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon? All right, Art, we have gotten to the point where it appears the manuscript from Spaulding's hand has made it into Joseph Smith's hand.
Correct.
How many years is it until Joseph Smith comes out and says, here it is, the Book of Mormon, I've translated it?
Okay. As I said a little bit earlier, he basically started the translation process around 1827 and finished it up by about 1829, and then the Book of Mormon actually came out in 1830. So we have about a three-year total timeline between the time that he more or less starts working on it and the time that it actually makes it into the public eye.
Now, before we go on, from what we know of Spaulding's story and what we can, of course, read now in the Book of Mormon, how similar do the two appear to be?
Oh, I love this. I love this question. because, you know, the Mormons claim that there are absolutely no parallels, there's nothing similar between the two works. And when they say that, they usually cite manuscript story, which is a real existing manuscript of Spaulding's and the first one that he wrote. They have the original of it at a place called Oberlin College, which is, I believe, in Ohio.
Correct.
The thing is, those same witnesses, many of the same witnesses who claimed that they saw Rigdon at the print shop and, you know, at various other places, and that they suspected Rigdon of purloining the manuscript, many or most of those same witnesses also heard Spaulding read his manuscript on a regular basis. And the different witnesses bring up different things, like hearing the names Nephi and Lehi and Lamanites, and others brought up things like Spaulding's extreme use of the phrase, "it came to pass," or variations on it. In fact, you could say that Spaulding was the nightly entertainment. Back in those days, they didn't have much in the way of any kind of entertainment, obviously nothing like radio or TV, but Spaulding would read his manuscript, and these various witnesses said that they heard him read the manuscript many times, and because he used that phrase, "it came to pass," so much, anybody who heard the thing even once or twice came to know Spaulding as old come to pass. And it's very interesting in that the 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon, it has over 1,500 instances of "it came to pass" or variations on it. And also very interestingly, in the next edition of the Book of Mormon, most, if not all, of those were taken out. And how does that compare with the Bible? Well, the Book of Mormon had 15 times more instances of the phrase "it came to pass" than the King James Bible.
Wayne, a couple of quick questions for you before we go to our callers.
Yes.
I noticed the similarity in names, Wayne Cowdery, Oliver Cowdery. Are we telling a bit of your own family history here?
Well, yes, actually. There's one thing that I'm on the air here that I should clear up here. The Mormons have accused me of claiming to be a direct descendant of Oliver Cowdery, and of course this was the publisher's fault of the first book. I've never ever claimed that, and I've never ever publicly have ever come out and made such a statement as that. In fact, I even told Donald Smith of the Mormon Church Archives, when he asked me if I was a direct descendant, I simply told him no. I was misquoted or it's a misstatement, but, you know, these kind of things happen. But nevertheless, we are both on the same family tree, he's actually related to my great-grandfather's side. So we are actually both on the same family tree, but I'm not a direct descendant of Oliver Cowdery.
And then, Wayne, when you were a Mormon, what did you believe about Joseph Smith? What were you taught to believe about Joseph Smith?
Well, that he was a prophet, of course, and that all the other churches were false, and that he was here to restore the gospel, and et cetera, pretty much what they teach, you know.
And just so we get your story straight, you were at one time a Mormon and have since been excommunicated from the Mormon Church. Is that correct?
Now, that's correct. Now, it has to relate, too, to what you were previously talking to Art Vanek about. The two works. This is what made me leave the church, was the fact that they lied here, and believes in the Doctrine and Covenants, that there wasn't a single phrase or similarity between the first work, which was the manuscript story, and the Book of Mormon. And so at my trial of excommunication, I said, well, that's quite true. I said, there's not one. I said, there are hundreds. Actually, there are scores of parallels between the two works. If you get down and start going through between the Book of Mormon and the manuscript story. So that's one of the main things that made me leave the church. I couldn't believe how many parallels that I found there, just uncanny, especially with the part with where I took a lever and raised a stone box and everything. The two introductions of the works were identical except for one thing, and that's one had the plates and the other one had parchment scrolls.
And then, Art, before we go to the calls, had Solomon Spaulding managed to live long enough or be quick enough in raising capital to publish manuscript found and actually published it as a piece of fiction, there never would have been a Book of Mormon.
I sure don't think so. The book would have been published in the mode that he wanted, which was to be nothing more than a romantic novel about the American Indians.
Our call in numbers 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. We go to the phones to our listeners listening on XM Radio in Utah. Jeff is up first. Jeff, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Jeff.
I have a question concerning my understanding that Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon had a big falling out for a period, and I guess when I guess it was Brigham Young that took over next. When he took over, he and Sidney Rigdon, I think, were at odds. Did Sidney Rigdon come out and say that, you know, when he was essentially left or excommunicated, I don't know, left that church, did he come out and say that he had got that manuscript? Because he wouldn't have had a reason to continue to try to support that the book came through Joseph Smith.
All right, Jeff, it's a good question. Thank you very much. Art, what do you know about it?
Well, there are a number of things. As your caller may or may not know, in the early church, there was a group known as the Danites or the Avenging Angels, and they were kind of enforcers and were used many times to, shall we say, get rid of people who were too much of a nuisance for the church. And Sidney knew about these and was constantly in fear that if he did come forward with any secrets, that his family or even he himself might be hurt. But there is a very interesting exchange that goes on between Rigdon and Young when they had that big conference after Smith's death, where Rigdon, who was bound and determined to head up the church, threatens Brigham Young by saying, you know, I'm going to expose my secrets. I'm going to tell my secrets.
Hold that thought right there, Art. I want to continue that on the other side of the break. A fascinating question and a fascinating answer. Art Vanek and Wayne Cowdery, members of the Spaulding Research Associates, join us to talk about the Book of Mormon. They're co-authors of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September. Who really wrote the Book of Mormon? You can order it by calling Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040. It's $16.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. And when you call, be sure to mention Issues Etc. and ask for the Book of the Month for September. Who really wrote the Book of Mormon? 1-800-325-3040. Or you can go to our website, issuesetc.org. You will find Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon there at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Our call-in numbers, we'll be taking your phone calls on the other side of the break as soon as Art completes his answer there. 1-800-730-2727.
What's the relationship between a novel written by a Revolutionary War veteran and the Book of Mormon? Who was Solomon Spaulding, and did he have a connection with Joseph Smith? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is titled, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon? You can find out more about this investigative history resource at our website, issuesetc.org. Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon cost $16.99 plus shipping and handling. Was the Book of Mormon given to Joseph Smith by an angel or created from a work of fiction? Find out with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September. Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon? 1-800-325-3040. or issuesetc.org. The title of the book again, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon?
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Dr. Jean Edward Veith, culture editor for World Magazine, on the value of LCMS World Relief.
Well, you know, whenever I see news of a disaster or a terrorist attack or a natural calamity, I hear that just immediately they're on the front lines of this. And as a Lutheran, I feel so proud about that, not in a boastful way, but I feel happy that Lutherans care about the suffering of others, as our theology teaches us to, that we're to live out our faith in love and service to our neighbors.
LCMS World Relief provides Christ-centered, cross-focused care and concern. For more information, contact them at 314-996-1683 or look for the LCMS World Relief logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Folks, here's our mailing address. It's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Here's our resource line number, 1-800-737-0172. You can use either of those to receive a free complimentary copy of our next issue's Etc. journal. I'm writing an article, by the way, on Eastern Orthodoxy for that next issue. Or you can help us defend the faith and teach the truth by making a tax-deductible gift to Issues, Etc. The address, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117, Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117, or call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. Art Jeff asked on the far side of the break about a showdown between Sidney Rigdon and Brigham Young. You say that Sidney Rigdon threatened to expose the whole operation
exactly,
at some point?
Exactly. They had a very heated discussion, and the reason that it built up to that was because Rigdon was really making a lot of noises about wanting to take over the church, and Brigham Young wanted the same thing, and each was in this power struggle to overwhelm the other, and Brigham Young was trying to take Sidney Rigdon's power away from him, and Rigdon countered by saying that he had more power than all of the apostles, and it all boils down to this one massive confrontation at this conference where Rigdon, like I said, I will expose my secrets, to which Brigham Young says, you tell yours, and we'll tell ours. At which point, Rigdon pretty much just ducked out of there like a dog with his tail between his legs.
So, actually, he said, when he first was confronted with him, he said, well, tit for tat. If Rigdon tells his secrets, we'll tell ours.
So some mutual blackmail going on, and Brigham Young eventually is the one who emerges as the next leader.
Now, it's interesting, though, because Rigdon wasn't finished yet. As he left there to go back to, I believe, Ohio, he approached Emma Smith to try and get Joseph Smith's, inspired translation of the Bible. And, of course, he didn't get it. And later on, when he was asked by people about Joseph's hand in the entire Book of Mormon process, he never affirmed it, but instead brought up Spalding, which is rather ironic. And going to the end of Rigdon's life, after he passed away, one of his grandsons published an article in a newspaper where he said that Grandpa Sidney was quite open about his involvement with Spalding and the Book of Mormon, and that it was not a secret at all, in spite of what the church claims and in spite of Sidney Rigdon's public claims and protests to the contrary.
1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Dan in Santa Rosa, California. He listens on KFAX. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I was wondering if you could tell me how many actual spelling errors, and I guess I want to include grammatical errors, were in Joseph Smith's original writings.
Oh, my goodness.
All right, let's see if we can explore that one, Dan, in the time left to us.
Yeah, I think so.
What do we know about, what do we know, if this is an inspired text, of course, what do we know about those particular statistics on the original manuscript of the Book of Mormon?
Well, that would get into textual analysis, and that is something that we did not devote a whole lot of time to. But by way of offering an answer, there was a point where there was where there were 116 pages of the Book of Mormon manuscript. And Martin Harris, who was Smith's scribe at the time, was kind of funding the whole operation, and Harris's wife didn't like that. And she wanted to see the book, and Harris approached Smith about it. Smith said no. They went back and forth several times. Finally, Harris grabs the book, takes it home, and Harris's wife either destroys or gives away those 116 pages and then goes to Smith and says, if you are a prophet of God and if you are translating this material as you claim, then you can retranslate those 116 pages. Then Joseph Smith came up with a revelation from God, allegedly, which said that those 116 pages would never be translated again, and then the Book of Mormon went on from there. So I know it's not exactly the same question, but I think it's an interesting fact that needs to be brought up. Certainly, if it was, in fact, a work of God, and it was being translated from plates that were in his alleged physical possession, one would think that he would have been able to translate them over again.
Listening on KFAX in Redwood City, California, Dave, welcome to Issues, Etc. Dave, welcome.
Yeah, hey. I want to speak something, you know. I'm a new member and a Mormon. And if this guy right here say he was a Mormon, right, you got to ask him what is the foundation of the church. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and why the church was called the Church of Jesus Christ. If Joseph Smith wanna be a prophet, why does he call it Joseph Smith Church?
Thank you very much, Dave. The question is to you then, Wayne. As a Mormon, what did you believe was the foundation of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints?
Well, actually, as I understood it, the foundation of the church was actually the Book of Mormon itself. And the way they really understand it was by praying over it, and that was apparently the main center of everything. Everything revolved around the Book of Mormon.
Art,
yes.
Do we have a solid historical case to be made here based upon the newspapers, the eyewitness accounts, that there really is a line from Solomon Spaulding to Joseph Smith from this piece of fiction to the Book of Mormon? 1 minute.
Wow. Well, we have witnesses who heard Spaulding read his book, and they describe parts of manuscript found. And those same parts are common to the Book of Mormon. We have other witnesses who place Sidney Rigdon in Pittsburgh at the same time as Spaulding, who place him with the manuscript. We have Spaulding and his wife, who both suspect Rigdon of stealing the book as early as 1814. We have other witnesses who place Rigdon with Smith at Smith's home several times. And so if you take all of those witnesses and all of the evidence and the newspaper articles and everything else and put them all together, it seems to lay a pretty clear path.
Folks, we'll continue to respond to your phone calls and your email on the Book of Mormon in the next hour. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. Mormon callers will get top priority again in the next hour. 1-800-730-2727. Also, our email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. You can submit questions or comments via that email right here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, you will not be able to hear the next hour on the radio. It's only on the Internet, but you can listen by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen Online, and the next hour is right there for you as we continue to take your questions and comments. We are coming to you live this Labor Day weekend. It's Sunday, the September the 4th. You can write this number down and give us a call during the break. 1-800-730-2727. Oh, we'll also give away copies of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon, to listeners with the best questions and comments on the Book of Mormon in the next hour. 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, the history is fascinating. There's no doubt about it. Even if there were no evidence of a history, an alternate origin for the Book of Mormon, we would still be faced with this problem, and that is the claims made by the Book of Mormon not only don't stand up to history, but they don't stand up in comparison to the Word of God in Holy Scripture. They bring a different Jesus, a different message of salvation, a different religion altogether. Now, I know that's what Joseph Smith intended to do. But as Christians examine the Book of Mormon, and as Mormons examine the Book of Mormon, they would do well to ask, do we find in these two books, the Bible and the Book of Mormon, the same Jesus Christ, the same salvation by grace through faith, for Jesus' sake only? That alone is enough to call into question the claims of the Book of Mormon and the church that is based upon it. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Call during this break, 1-800-730-2727.
Listen each week to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of Worldwide KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.